Now, as the weather warms up, you might be thinking it's a great time to get outside and enjoy the great outdoors in Wisconsin.
One roadblock for a lot of people might be the bugs and insects, the diseases they carry in particular. 2 years ago, entomologist Susan Paskowitz only found 32 immature deer ticks when doing research in the UW Arboretum in Madison. A year later, 592 of those immature deer ticks.
She joins us now to talk about her research about ticks in Wisconsin and her work to reduce tick populations. Susan Paskowitz is professor and chair of the Department of Entomology at UW-Madison. Susan, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. Thanks for the opportunity.
So just those numbers there, kind of staggering. 32 immature deer ticks 2 years ago, a year later, 592 immature deer ticks. Do we know why there seems to be a boom in the tick population in Wisconsin?
We were a little startled by those numbers, but in this case, the Madison area is a newly invaded site for the state. So deer ticks here started up in the northwestern part of the state, and then slowly over the last 40, 50 years have really moved into new areas. And Madison is one of those areas, along with places like Milwaukee and the southeastern part of the state. And so when I first moved here in the early 1990s, I would go looking around the city to try to find a place to work in my own backyard, and I couldn't find them. They really weren't here. And then about 5 years ago, in 2010, one of my colleagues was doing some work in the Arb, and she was trapping some rodents. She found one deer tick on one rodent. We went back the next year. We found a few more, and then since then, we've been monitoring it steadily. So it started kind of low during the invasion. I think what we saw last year was that inflection point where it went from newly invaded to kind of fully invaded.
Yeah, I think ticks are, everyone agrees, they're kind of a drag if you get them. You have to go through an ordeal to pull them off. But more than that, I mean, ticks carry Lyme disease, which is something we worry about. So does that mean we're also seeing a boom in tick-borne diseases like Lyme disease?
You know, we have seen a steady increase in the number of people in Wisconsin who get infected. When I first got here in the early 1990s, it was usually about 400 to 500 cases that were reported to the state each year. Last year, I think it was well over 3,500. And according to CDC, who's done some studies of this, this is probably about a tenfold underestimate. So
wow.
It's a lot more likely, 30, 36,000 people getting infected with Lyme every year. So, you know, we've seen this steady increase, and I think it really reflects probably a couple of things. One is there are more ticks, and there are more ticks in more places, so they're now in parts of the state where you never used to see them. And then in a number of those places where we've been following them, and as well as some of our colleagues, the infection rates, the number of ticks that are actually infected with Lyme disease has been going up.
Well, so you've got Lyme disease, and those numbers are alarming to begin with, but it sounds like ticks also carry some other diseases, too. Is that right?
That is. Actually, in Wisconsin, I think we now know of 5 or 6 different pathogenic microorganisms that can make people sick. Most of them are really rare, and most people are never going to encounter them, or if they do, they're not even going to get sick. There is one other pathogen, though, besides Lyme, that is becoming more common, and it's called human anaplasmosis, or anaplasma is the name of the bacteria that makes you sick. And we're beginning to see, kind of like when I first got here, we have about 500 cases now of anaplasmosis, and Wisconsin and Minnesota are real hot spots for that disease, where Lyme, you also see a lot of it on the East Coast. You don't see so much anaplasma there. There's something interesting about our state and the upper Midwest in relation to that pathogen.
So if you want to get outside, and of course after a long winter in Wisconsin, everybody wants to get outside, what can you do to reduce the chances that you'll be bitten by a tick?
That's a great question. So, you know, you've got a couple of things to worry about. One is that if you're going out just recreationally, you're going to be in beautiful wooded areas, hopefully hiking and doing other things out there. You want to, as much as possible, stay in the middle of the hard-packed trails because usually, you know, where there's a lot of traffic, a lot of walking on a wide trail in the center is not where we would tend to find ticks when we go out looking for them. They're going to be a lot more abundant kind of off to the side in the vegetation where the leaf litter is a little thicker and provides them with the level of humidity that they need. They actually turn out to be extremely sensitive to drying out. And so nice, very humid conditions like you get out in the woods is where they tend to thrive. So staying in the middle of the trail, that's one thing you can do that will definitely help. Another thing that we recommend is that people think about using a repellent. We actually do a couple of things. We use a repellent that would be the same thing that we would use for mosquitoes. But then we also spray our clothing, our socks and our shoes with something called permethrin, which you can buy at most department stores. And you put that on your clothes, you let it dry, and then it kind of serves as a repellent for the tick and also protects you because the tick will walk up your pants, get exposed to this chemical, and it will kill it before it can transmit the Lyme disease to you.
It's called permethrin. Is that something that's sold, you know, among the regular bug repellents that you find? Or
yes,
is this something...
it is, actually. It is. So you can go into pretty much any department store and they'll have it there.
Well, when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about what you're doing to reduce tick populations, because with this boom, that's something we're taking stock of now as well. We'll keep going talking about that with entomologist Susan Paskowitz, talking about her research on tick populations in Wisconsin and, of course, how to reduce those numbers. We'll continue that conversation in just a few minutes.
And you can find more info at the Central Time Facebook page. And while you're there, let us know if you've encountered ticks already this season. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing our conversation with entomologist Susan Paskowitz about her research on ticks in Wisconsin. The bad news, they seem to be booming. We're looking at increased numbers in areas of the state where they weren't found so much before, areas, for instance, like southern Wisconsin. And Susan, you're doing some work to reduce tick populations because, as we said, they are booming some areas. What sorts of things are you doing to try to cut down on those numbers?
Yeah, so a minute ago we were talking about what people can do when they're recreating, when they're out walking on trails. But we were also worried about what people could do in their own backyards because as the ticks become more abundant, more and more people are being exposed right around their homes, especially people who are living in wooded areas. And so a couple of things we're trying. One is playing on that idea that the ticks really require a lot of high humidity to be healthy, to stay healthy. And to reduce that, what we've been doing is reducing an invasive species called buckthorn, which in our studies has shown a really tight relationship with the higher populations of the tick. So we've been removing that from a number of different half-acre plots and then seeing the impacts. And then the second thing that we're doing is actually targeting a species of mouse called the white-footed mouse. The white-footed mouse is a great host for the immature stages of the ticks, and it's also the major source where they get infected by the Lyme disease pathogen. And the way we target the mice is we give them a nest material, cotton balls basically, that have been sprayed, again, with that permethrin that I was recommending people think about treating their clothing with. So we spray the cotton balls, we put them out in these little tubes all around these half-acre simulated yards, and then the mice come out at night, they take the cotton balls back, they make their nests out of it, and then every time they go down into the burrow, down into the nest, they get a treatment of the permethrin onto their fur. And what that does is any tick then that attaches to that mouse gets the permethrin treatment, which kills the tick, prevents the tick from becoming infected with the pathogen, prevents the tick from infecting the mouse with the pathogen, and really very significantly in our study here at least is reducing both the number of ticks and the number of infected ticks that are in those environments.
That's so interesting. So does the permethrin that you're talking about, do you know anything about whether it poses any health risks to the mice and by extension maybe to people who would want to use it?
Right. Super good question. So, you know, this is the same idea that you can spray it on your clothes, and as long as you allow it to dry, you don't want to put it on your skin, right? But if you put it on your clothes and allow it to dry, it doesn't have any negative health impacts. It's actually something that the military uses in uniforms for soldiers to prevent them from being exposed to ticks while they're on maneuver. So it's a safe and well-tested compound. And actually, you can buy clothing where somebody's already done this for you if you just go online and look for it.
Of course, it's going to be summertime. A lot of people are going to be wearing shorts, so they might have those thick boots on, but then have, you know, bare legs after that. Is that something that, you know, if you put it on your your boots, it will stop the ticks there?
You can put it on your boots, and a lot of times they are getting on low to the ground, but there are some that are going to be a little higher up, and so it's not going to be as effective as if you put it on all your clothes and wear the long pants. I would recommend in that case that people go back and do a very careful tick check when they get home. Also, get in the shower, get a scrubby, and kind of really rub your body down and make sure that you're being as careful as you can to try to remove them early. And then watch for those symptoms and make sure you get to your doctor right away if you should have any of those symptoms.
Well, Susan, with the numbers of ticks that you're talking about and the numbers of incidents of Lyme disease in Wisconsin these days, I mean, are we to the point where parents should think about going camping, think twice about going camping where people are going to be lying on the ground in a tent and things like that? Is it that serious a health risk, or is this something where, well, no, we should still get out there, but you should just really take precautions?
Oh, I would agree with the latter. I think everybody should be out in the woods as much as they can. It's good for you. It's good for your soul. You really need to have that experience, but you also need to be alert and aware of the potential risks and making sure that you are checking your children carefully and that you are setting up your tent in an area where maybe it's a little more open, a little more sunny, and so that the tick risk is going to be a lot lower.
What about pets? Because I imagine a tick could hop onto a pet and come back and jump in your lap, and then boom, you got a tick bite. So how should we handle that?
Yes, you do want to protect your animals because, of course, they can get disease as well as be a source of the ticks actually transferring from them, as you say, onto your lap or onto your body. And so there are some really good treatments that you can get from your vet. They're spot on. An example that I use for my little dog is a compound called Frontline, and you just put a little bit of a drop of this down the back of the animal, and they're protected. Again, it's kind of the same way. You put this on the animal, the ticks get on. They don't die, like, instantly, but they die before they can transmit pathogens. So it helps to protect both their health and the owner's health.
And you mentioned buckthorn as one of the things that you're working on to reduce tick populations, an invasive species that makes it moister so ticks are happier. They like it when it's a little moist. Is that something that people should be thinking about in their own backyards, trying to make it less tick hospitable?
Yes, and there are a lot of really good ways that you can do that. One is, you know, the areas where you're going to be spending most of your time, again, that kind of open, sunny, grassy area, those are not places that these ticks really like. So that's where you want to have your barbecue and your play set for the kids. And then if you do have, you know, ornamental plantings, or if you've got places where there is a lot of leaf litter and more vegetation, again, if you're going to have paths and going through that, keep those wider. You can also contact pest control operators, and they're able to use some real low-impact, low-volume pesticides in those perimeter areas that would help to keep the ticks from getting into the yard. Another thing you ought to be thinking about is not trying to attract animals right into your yard, especially deer, or having places where the mice could harbor. Those are other spots where you may want to consider having some treatment done.
And Susan, just super briefly as we wrap up here, where can people go for more information about ticks in Wisconsin?
So I have a website, and if they just would Google Wisconsin ticks, they will find out pretty much everything they want to know about ticks and tick-borne disease in our state.
Well, Susan, thank you so much for joining us and telling us what to do about these ticks.
Oh, thank you very much.
That was Susan Paskowitz, professor and chair of the Department of Entomology at UW-Madison, and she joined us to talk about her research on tick populations in Wisconsin as the weather gets warmer and more people are spending time outdoors.
And you can find more information, as our guest mentioned. We've got a link on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a gastroenterologist about common reasons people experience bloating and some possible solutions.
Don't forget, it's our spring membership drive. Make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. You're listening to Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Now, a topic that everybody experiences, but not everybody wants to talk about, bloating. Some people experience bloating for a whole variety of reasons, including ones that might surprise you. Swallowing air, for example, can be one reason behind bloating.
And bloating is something that can be uncomfortable, and it can also be a sign that there's something wrong with your digestive health. Our next guest says gastrointestinal health is really crucial to our overall health and our happiness and well-being.
Dr. Robin Chutkin is back with us now to talk about her new book. It's called The Bloat Cure, 101 Natural Solutions for Real and Lasting Relief. She's a gastroenterologist and the founder of the Digestive Center for Women. Dr. Chutkin, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Robin, Veronica. It's great to be back.
So when we first started talking about this topic at one of our meetings, people were wondering, well, what exactly is bloat? So let's start there. How do you define what bloat is?
So it refers to an excess of gas and air in the digestive tract. It can be fluid also, but generally when we think of bloating, we think of excessive air in the digestive tract that leads to increased abdominal girth and, as Rob said, a lot of discomfort.
And I think a lot of people probably experience this and think, it is what it is. I've got this. There's not much I can do about it. And if I read one main point from your book, you're saying, no, if you do some work, if you do some searching, you can find a cause and probably a solution.
Absolutely. The goal of the book was to allow people to be a little bit of a medical detective when it comes to their bloating and to figure out what's causing it. Is it something you're eating? Is it a medication you're taking? Is it hormonal imbalance? Is it something anatomical? There are lots of things that conspire to bloat us, and there are lots of things we can do about it.
Well, do you think in the pantheon of things that can be wrong with a person, things that can go wrong with a human body, there's lots of them. Why should we worry about bloating?
Well, it's a sign that all is not well in the digestive tract. You know, there's so many things that affect the GI tract. When you think about it, everything that you ingest eventually ends up in the GI tract. Medications are metabolized through the digestive tract. Even things we put on our skin can end up in our digestive tract. So there, you know, it's a way of our body giving us important feedback through the gut that all is not well. And so it's important to take heed and not just ignore it.
Let's look through your book now. You've got a lot of causes, like 100 or so causes potential of bloating. I'll list it alphabetically. Why did you set up the book that way?
Well, again, I wanted it to be easy for people to use, Rob. I love this idea of medical detectives, of, you know, kind of rolling your sleeves up and figuring out what's going on, and also figuring out when you might need some professional help. So I do emphasize with some of the diagnoses what I call the red flag or alarm signs that could be a sign of something more serious, whether a form of cancer, serious infection, that kind of thing. Unfortunately, those are the exception rather than the norm. But I wanted it to be easy for people to use. So going through it A to Z makes it a little bit easy and maybe even a little bit fun as you think about it.
Well, let's look at the very first letter of the alphabet, your first entry, A, acid reducers. Now, this is something that affects a lot of people, lots of people taking acid reduction medications. What does that have to do with bloat?
It has a lot to do with bloat. So there's been a lot of information in the media recently about these class of acid-suppressing drugs, particularly the proton pump inhibitors, a little purple pill and so on, being linked to kidney disease and dementia and heart disease, but they really disrupt digestion. So having acid in the stomach to help break food down and to create the exactly right pH for digestive enzymes to work is an integral part of digestion. And when you change that as profoundly as these drugs do by really changing the pH from acidic to alkali, you create a nice, friendly, hospitable environment for bacteria to overgrow in the upper GI tract where they really shouldn't be in very high numbers. And so you can get bacterial overgrowth. And what do bacteria do? They produce lots of bloating, hydrogen and methane gas and so on. So that's one way that these drugs contribute to bloating, but they also interfere with digestion. And so you can get improper and incomplete absorption of important nutrients like magnesium and calcium and iron, vitamin D. This can lead to osteoporosis. So in addition to bloating, there are lots of things that can happen when you stay on these drugs long term.
These are super commonly used medications for people who are thinking, okay, I'm taking this, maybe I can get away from it. The solution, as I understand it, is not just to throw the pills away and be done with them today.
Yeah, you have to be careful how you taper off these drugs, because when you block acid as efficiently and effectively as these drugs do, when you stop the medication, there can often be a surge of acid and an increase in your symptoms. So it's important to taper slowly. It's important to check with your doctor to see if you have a particular condition. Maybe you're at risk for esophageal cancer, some of these other conditions that might necessitate you still being on the drug. So it's important to do it with the supervision of your healthcare provider, but it's also important to push that healthcare provider to come off the drug. These drugs were initially approved really just for use for a couple months at a time to heal ulcers, but now we use them long term. I have patients who've been on these drugs for decades, and it's really messing up their digestion.
One of the other pieces of advice you give is to remember that your stomach has a bedtime. What do you mean by that?
The contractility of the gastrointestinal tract, particularly the stomach, is tied to the light-dark cycle, what we call the circadian rhythm. So as we're approaching the summer equinox now in the middle of June, getting towards it, it's getting dark later and later. So in D.C., where I live, at around this time a few months ago, it was pitch black, and now the sun is still shining through, poking through a little bit of clouds today. And so it changes over time. In the winter, the sun sets at about 5, 5:30, and in the summertime, that can be 8 or 8:30. And so your contractility changes. So in the winter, you really have to eat an earlier dinner. And in the summertime, we have the luxury of eating a little bit later, because once the sun sets, the contractility goes way down. And unfortunately, most of us are dumping the majority of our calories into our sleepy stomach that's barely contracting late at night when the sun is set. And to add insult to injury, we're also reclining shortly after that, so we don't have the benefit of gravity to help things get from north to south, and movement. We're sort of reclining and we're sedentary, so it's sort of a triple threat of the stomach's barely contracting, we don't have the benefit of gravity, and we're not moving to stimulate peristalsis, and that's just a major setup for bloating.
Talking to Dr. Robin Chutkan about her new book, The Bloat Cure, 101 Natural Solutions for Real and Lasting Relief. Well, Dr. Chutkan, you write that one reason we sometimes have air in our digestive system is that we're swallowing lots of air, and we can do that in a bunch of different ways. What are some of the things we should watch for?
This is one I love, aerophagia, because it's so common and it's so easily treatable. People have aerophagia sometimes because they have a deviated septum, but commonly, too, they have allergies and they're mouth breathers, particularly this time of year in the spring when the pollen counts are high. So if you're breathing through your mouth, you're more likely to be swallowing a lot of air. We also see this when people are talking on the cell phone and they're eating and they're talking fast, multitasking, doing a lot of different things, drinking while eating, and it can cause air to get swallowed. Instead of air going into your respiratory tract, it goes into your GI tract, and it really fills your stomach up. So by the end of the day, you can really feel like the Michelin man or woman and be full of air and have sort of a tense, uncomfortable digestive tract. People who have aerophagia often have a lot of burping, and that can be a sign if your abdomen is getting more and more distended as the day goes on and you're burping a lot, sucking on hard candy, chewing gum. These are things that can add to it. So one of the simplest things is just to really be mindful when you're eating, slow it down, and try not to drink and gulp a lot of liquids in between meals, and of course, spit out the hard candy and the gum.
No, I heard you say if you're the, you feel like the Michelin man or woman. Is it a man or woman thing? I feel like this is one of those things that women talk about a lot, and they've got a lot on their plates in terms of feeling pressure about their appearances. Do we have to add bloat to that list? Is it mostly women?
Well, you know, some of the things are equal opportunity employers, like the acid blockers and the aerophagia. But the real difference, Veronica, is that men have a built-in Sphinx in the form of their abdominal wall because of higher testosterone levels. So even a woman who works out a lot and has a well-developed abdominal wall typically doesn't have the same level of musculature in the abdomen. Men have, again, this built-in Sphinx holding everything in. So even a man who has a big bear belly will rarely complain of feeling bloated. He'll complain of feeling fat and having a bear belly. But underneath that bear belly, he tends to have a taut abdominal wall that's holding the bowels in and is less prone to bloating. Women also have longer digestive tracts. Our colon, on average, is about 10 centimeters longer, which might not seem like a lot, but that extra 10 centimeters leads to a lot of extra twists and turns, redundancy. And we also share space with our reproductive organs. In women, we have the bladder, we have the uterus, the fallopian tubes, the ovaries. There's a lot of hardware down there, and the bowels tend to get a bit squished. And so with the less room, there's more bloating. So those are some anatomical and hormonal reasons why women tend to have more bloating than men.
Let's talk about some of the food we eat. It's pledge drive time here. A lot of sugary substances show up at Wisconsin Public Radio. What's the impact of sugar and artificial sweeteners when it comes to bloating?
You're sort of darned if you do and darned if you don't, because sugar tends to feed the excessive sugar, not a little bit of dark chocolate here and there.
So three donuts, say, is not as fun.
Yeah, three donuts, for example, tends to encourage growth of the wrong type of bacteria and yeast species in the gut. And so when you develop imbalance between the good bacteria and the not-so-good bacteria, again, you get overgrowth and a lot of methane and hydrogen gas and a lot of uncomfortable bloating. Artificial sweeteners, though, are a particularly bad idea when it comes to the gut, because the reason they don't contribute calories calories is because they're not broken down and absorbed in the small intestine where most carbohydrates are. So they flow on down to the colon where they get fermented by gut bacteria, and that fermentation results in a lot of extra gas and really uncomfortable bloating and gas. If you've ever had candy that's designed for diabetics or chocolate with a lot of artificial sweetener in it, you'll experience really bad gas and bloating with that. So I say calories over chemicals every time. Stick to regular sugar, but eat less of it, or even better, a little bit of organic raw honey, which has a lower glycemic index than table sugar and doesn't result in as much bacterial overgrowth.
And Dr. Chutkan, as we wrap up, we hear a lot about the promise of probiotics, and I think we're just sort of starting to figure out their potential and how to use them. But do you recommend a probiotic to help put your gut in good working order?
I recommend probiotics in particular situations and people who've had an infectious diarrhea where a lot of their healthy gut bacteria has been wiped out, or people who've been on a lot of antibiotics. There's certain conditions like forms of inflammatory bowel disease where probiotics have been proven to help. But a general probiotic for everyone, I'm not sure we can make a case for that. And it's really important to choose a probiotic appropriately. It needs to have enough live bacteria to actually do something, to make a difference. And it has to have typically several strains of bacteria because they all work together. So probably more important than a probiotic is avoiding antibiotics whenever possible and eating a plant-based diet that's rich in indigestible plant fiber, which will feed your existing bacteria and help you to grow a good gut garden.
Are there any particular plants that you recommend we eat?
There are foods that are high in a kind of fiber called inulin. So that's things like leeks and asparagus, artichokes, onion, garlic, oats are great, and anything with stringy fiber like celery. Those are all really great for gut bacteria.
We leave it there, Dr. Chutkan. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. Robin Chutkan, gastroenterologist and founder of the Digestive Center for Women. She's the author of the new book, The Bloat Cure, 101 Natural Solutions for Real and Lasting Relief.